diamond. I want a girl who knows what's best. I want a girl with shoes that cut and eyes that burn like cigarettes. I want a girl with the right allocations, who is fast and thorough and sharp as a tack. She's playing with her jewelry, she's putting up her hair, she's touring the facility and picking up slack. I want a girl with a short skirt and a long jacket.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballinger. Great to have you here with us. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Check us out on our website, golfnewsnet.com. Find my work at Yahoo Sports' Devil Ball Golf Blog on sports.yahoo.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ryan Ballinger, facebook.com/golfnewsnet. There are a zillion ways to try to get a hold of me. I will be running from all of them, but feel free to follow me for the occasional thought that I choose to share. We have hopefully an interesting show for you this week. I thought we've had some good shows to start the year, but first I wanted to let you know we are presented by BetDSI.com. BetDSI.com is where you can get all your golf action if you're a degenerate like myself. And you can also check out our website, GolfNewsNet.com, for all of our weekly golf odds that we do for all the major events around the world. And we're going to expand that this year, so we'll have every PGA Tour event. We'll have a number of European Tour events and LPGA Tour events as well when they're covered and when the lines are offered. And they'll be directly from BetDSI.com. So check them out. So let's first start with the great shorts debate of 2016. And I say that as I'm cowering in fear in the field position of 2 feet of snow coming to the Washington, D.C. area starting tomorrow evening, or afternoon, I should say, and carrying through Saturday evening. It's going to be a lot of freaking snow. And not only that, but we're expected to get gusts of wind in the area of 45 to 50 miles per hour, which means this is indeed a blizzard. And we get one of these every 5 years or so here. So, you know, I've been through these in my lifetime. I'm almost 33 years old. And you kind of just know it's coming. It's coming every 4 to 5, maybe 6 years, but it's coming, darn it. And so it's here now, and we'll get to contend with it over the weekend. So that's also why we're delayed by a day or so on the podcast, because we're trying to get ready for cataclysmic problems here. So, anyhow, we got a shorts debate in golf, and it is absolutely hilarious that we are having it. Because thank you to Darren Clark last week in the Eurasia Cup, which is the European Tour's version of the Ryder Cup that pits Europe versus Asia. And they were in Malaysia, and it's freaking hot in Kuala Lumpur, and Darren Clark, the head of the European team, got a little bit of practice for the Ryder Cup, went to the tournament officials and said, hey, we want to wear shorts during the practice round because it's too freaking hot. And tournament officials said, no, you got to wear pants. And so Darren Clark, again, he's the sitting Ryder Cup captain, so he's got Keith Pelley's phone number probably in the most used contacts list on his phone, gets a hold of Keith Pelley somehow and says, hey, we want to wear shorts. Keith Pelley goes, yeah, why not? I mean, why is that a problem? So all of a sudden, get the go-ahead to wear shorts, and everybody in the European team is basically doing it. You get Westwood, you get Clark, you get Poulter. I think Keimer did it. I mean, you had a bunch of people who were playing in shorts in the practice rounds, and it was great. I mean, there's no problem with it. Guys are walking around in shorts in 100-degree weather. That's totally cool by me. And then you get to this week in Abu Dhabi, and these guys continue to wear shorts in the practice rounds on Monday, Tuesday, and on Tuesday night, the European Tour's Tournament Committee, a 15-person group that votes on these kinds of matters, and it's more player-based on the European Tour as opposed to the 9-member policy board on the PGA Tour, which is rigged against the players 5-4. But this tournament committee got together and said, okay, we're going to let people wear shorts during practice rounds and pro-ams, and that's going to continue throughout the season, and we'll see where that leads. And this created some kind of insane uproar about shorts. I mean, I wrote a story about it because I thought it was neat. Like, okay, shorts are fine. Let's move on with the world. I mean, I wear shorts when I play golf. You probably do if you play golf, and you probably do it when it's hot out, and you don't do it when it's cold out. And it doesn't seem lazy or unfashionable. You probably put just as much thought into what shorts you put on as what pants you put on. It's not like you get to go ahead to put on shorts, and you put on, like, sweat shorts and like a yoga shirt, and then show up to the golf course. You still put on nice shorts and a nice shirt and reasonable shoes, and you go out there and play golf. What's the problem with that? But so many folks are up in arms. It's got to be pants. It should always be pants. It's unprofessional not to wear pants. Pants, pants, pants. This is not some kind of case of indecent exposure here. This is the difference between having things covering your shins and not covering your shins. I don't think that tells you whether you're a professional or not a professional. Because otherwise, pretty much every other sport would be in trouble. Because in football, you basically wear plus fours that are skin tight. In basketball, you wear shorts that come barely over your knees these days. We've come a long way since the 80s, thank God. And baseball is really the only major sport in which you wear pants. Even in hockey, you don't wear pants. You wear shorts with, like, longer shorts, but they're big, fluffy shorts. I mean, they're big, puffy things that you can wear pads underneath. They're shorts. Shorts, shorts, shorts. There's shorts everywhere. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, no, it looks terrible. And, you know, to try to defend the point, I think that it was Jeff Shackelford who put it up on his site. And I thought it was an interesting description of when you're at a golf tournament and you hear the click-clack of spikes, because hopefully you're not wearing spikes, because if you're wearing spikes as a spectator golf tournament, you should go home and change your shoes. But when you hear the click-clack of spikes at a professional golf tournament, you turn around, you expect to see a well-dressed person. And that person is supposed to carry themselves as a professional, and so the way that they dress kind of communicates that to you, and that they're not just some jerk-off fan, I guess, who decided to show up and look exactly like the guys who are playing, even though he's clearly not. I understand that. I understand there's an expectation there, but guess what? When you walk into an NFL game and there are thousands of people, men and women, children, wearing the quarterback or running back or wide receiver, best defensive player's jersey, there is no confusion there. You don't go, oh, that's the football player. You go, oh, that's a fat guy with a beer in his hand. Okay, fine. You know, we're good. Well, I know who that is. That is a mom of two. She's got a kid with a jersey on. She is not playing middle linebacker today. Got it. You know, there's no confusion there. And I don't think there really is a whole lot of confusion about who a professional golfer is when you get to a tournament. It's pretty clear who it is. The way they carry themselves, like they've been there. All the logos, they walk with kind of a demeanor, a seriousness to it. They're definitely not carrying beer. They're not talking much. They're trying to get places quickly. They're doing things with purpose. You know who the golfers are. It doesn't take a whole lot of mystery to figure it out. And so the whole thing, this has to be nice pants, like golf-appropriate pants. It just seems overblown to me. And I would be totally fine if the PGA Tour, oh, first the European Tour, then the PGA Tour, perhaps by peer pressure, says, okay, well, we'll just let everybody wear shorts during tournament rounds and pro-am rounds and all of that, and fine. Let's see how it goes. I mean, try it out at a few tournaments. See how it goes. Don't necessarily give it a blanket A-OK at first if you're going to do this for tournament rounds, but this kind of thing happens in U.S. Open qualifiers every year in June, you know, the week before. Pretty much every pro that's in one of those qualifying tournaments is wearing shorts because it's hot. And the stops that they're at is usually you're either Memphis, where it's scorching in June, or you're in Columbus, Ohio, where, you know, near the Memorial, where it's not necessarily hot, but it could get hot, and if it is, then the guys are wearing shorts there too. So I don't understand the reaction to all of this. This is literally the difference between woven thread on your body for 24 inches of it or less, depending on how long your leg below the knee is, and that's it. Let's move on with life. So I cannot implore people enough to just get over it and get on to something else. If you've got a problem about things that are going on in golf, there are plenty of things to be mad about in golf. Shorts is probably not one of them. And for that end, I believe very strongly that in most places, especially publicly accessible places to play golf, private club, you can do whatever the hell you want, but in publicly accessible golf courses, I think the loosening of the dress code, the loosening of those restrictions is ultimately a good thing for the sport. If you follow any kind of high-level amateur or even a minor pro on Instagram, you see them taking video of their shots, their practices, they're wearing casual clothing. In some cases, the women are wearing kind of leggings or yoga pants. and fairly tight-fitting clothing. If you're a guy, they're wearing kind of athletic shorts or even kind of tennis-style wear, which I've worn on the golf course before, and it's very comfortable, and it is not bad-looking. And I think that's totally fine. There's no reason to tell people they can't play golf because of the clothes they don't have. That seems like a limiting factor up front. We already limited them by telling them they've got to pay $40 just to play, and then they've got to have their own clubs, and that costs a few hundred bucks at least. And that's if you get crappy ones. And then you have to have a certain kind of clothing, which you may not have. So before you even play a round of golf, you're down several hundred dollars, and that's assuming that you buy the crappiest of everything. If you don't go full bore into it, like that time you took up skiing for a week and you bought the nicest stuff and now it's in your closet, you spend a lot of money on that. And you're going to spend a lot of money on golf stuff just to get in the game, just to show up on the first tee. So to make that investment a little bit lighter, we can loosen the dress code restrictions. I think that makes a whole ton of sense to me. It also makes sense to me to have kind of the Chevrolet of golf clubs that offers modest technology, not completely modern technology, at modest prices. But no one seems to want to be able to do that. So, or no one's at least thought to do that yet. But I guess for whatever reason, the old guard wants to defend tradition. And there's, by the way, nothing wrong with tradition in certain contexts. You do certain things because they're the right thing to do. You shake hands with your playing opponent after the fact because it's the right thing to do. It's an expression of good sportsmanship. Me wearing pants or not has no bearing on that. Has no bearing on whether or not people see me as a good competitor, an enjoyable person to play with, all of those things. Now, if I showed up to the first tee in a jock strap and nothing else, there'd be a problem, and I would understand that. So there's certain lines, I guess, and for varying people, the lines change. I got it. But I think all of the pros, especially the reaction this weekend in Abu Dhabi, I mean, the reaction was almost universally, hooray, this is great. And so I guess there's an equal and opposite reaction of folks who go, oh, this isn't that great. It's not that good. I don't like it. Afraid of change. Hate change. Don't change anything. Don't give me that modern cell phone that has like a zillion apps on it, can do everything I want in life from it. No. I like a flip phone, please. I'd like something that could barely make phone calls and I can barely type the alphabet on so I can send text messages. I'd love a camera that has just 1 megapixel on it so it does nothing. I'm afraid of change. In fact, if it would be ideal if we went back to the era where they were trying to make cell phones as small as humanly possible so I can get one that's basically the size of my Bluetooth device. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Now, people are very selective in the change that they want to embrace and that they don't want to embrace. And I get that. But this is a change you should be willing to embrace. Or at least see how it plays out. Don't just give it the blanket no before you ever actually see it happen. And that's the point about these pro-am and practice rounds. Very few people see them. The PGA Tour has gone out of its way for the events that it manages to shut down Mondays and sometimes Tuesdays as access to the tournament. So, because people don't come. I mean, why would you have volunteers come? Why would you have a staff there to man a tournament where no one's showing up for the practice rounds? Do it on Wednesday. Make that the be-all, end-all. And so the same thing's happening on the European Tour, where the crowds are way more sparse for so many events. I mean, they don't come to the tournament rounds, so much less who cares who shows up to the practice rounds. If you're coming to the practice round or a pro-am on the European Tour, there's a good chance you're either playing that day or you're playing in the tournament, or you have absolutely nothing better to do. That's about it. So, good for you, Keith Pelly. Tell people, you know, we got to embrace some change here. Now, the other change that happened of significance on the European Tour that I think has some buzz going on today is Jordan Spieth. Let me take a step back. The European Tour's new pace of play policy. Now, I didn't realize that they didn't really have a pace of play policy in the past, where the former policy basically was, if you fell behind, the European Tour official would come up to you and go, play faster. And the player would go, okay, and try hard. And just try not to be blatant about the disregard for time par. And that would be it. So Keith Pelly said at the end of the 2015 calendar year in Dubai, and said, we can't have this anymore. Slow play is killing the game. People hate slow golf. They want to watch action. They don't want to watch walking. We're going to do something about it. And he unveiled the first part of that plan in Abu Dhabi. It said, okay, well, if you fall behind time par of the group in front of you, so if you go off in 10-minute intervals, if you are 10 minutes behind markers, kind of marker posts throughout the course of that group, you'll get put on the clock. And from there, you'll have 40 seconds to execute each shot, or 50 if you're the first to play. And if you violate that, then you get what's called a monitoring penalty, which in PGA Tour parlance is a bad time. And if you get that, then you are subject to a £2,600 or $2,800 fine for each bad time thereafter. And that sounds absolutely meaningless. I mean, it's better than what it was, but it's ultimately meaningless because there are no strokes involved. And the European Tour doesn't assess in strokes. The PGA Tour hasn't assessed a penalty stroke to a player for slow play, the PGA Tour, since 1991. We had Guan Tian Lang get it at the Masters a handful of years ago. But the PGA Tour doesn't do it. And so without the threat of strokes, I mean, you're asking Jordan Spieth, if he gets another bad time this week, to pay $2,800. Last year, I think he made $5,000 a shot. A shot. So half of a shot, and he's paid the fine. That's meaningless to a top-tier player. There's no incentive to play fast. For a bottom feeder, that means something, sure. I mean, it's the difference between making money that week and not, if you're on the lower fringes of the European Tour. But not for a top-tier player who's going over there who's getting $1 million just to show up anyway. It's a $2.7 million purse. I mean, for guys like McIlroy and Fowler and Stenson and Keimer and Spieth, certainly, $2.7 million sounds like a pittance compared to what you see every week on the PGA Tour, even on the low end, which is like $5.5, $5.8 million nowadays. More and more events are getting over the $6 million mark. The high-end events are nearly the $10 million mark. So a $2.7 million purse means basically nothing to them. They are making more money, the best guys, showing up than what they'll get if they win. That's remarkable. So you're telling me that a $2,800 fine is really going to sway the opinion of those players, and you have to be kidding yourself. And I appreciate that Pelly is trying to make an incremental stance here, trying to make some kind of change in the culture of the European Tour, which is historically a little bit faster, I think, in terms of play than the PGA Tour. And part of that is because as the money goes up, you get a little bit more nervous, you're more cognizant of what's happening with each and every shot in terms of the money that it could cost you for screwing it up. But it doesn't strike me as it has any teeth. And he said that, well, there's more to come. Well, there needs to be more to come. And by more to come, I mean there needs to be penalty strokes. You should have to pay penalty strokes if you play slowly. Because if you play slowly, then you ultimately are having an impact on your playing partners. You're also having an impact on the entire field that's on the golf course. Everyone behind you. If you're playing slow, they go slow. And it just filters through. It reverberates. And so if that's the case and you slow roll it, then you're forcing maybe faster players to slow roll it, which that throws off their rhythm and they don't like. I mean, I could talk to that from personal experience. And you probably can too, from being on a golf course, if you're on a publicly accessible course, or even a country club on the weekends, and you're playing, and you'd like to be a fast player, and you know, I'm someone who likes to play by themselves or with one or two other people in the middle of the afternoon when no one's really around. You can get around as quickly as you can, versus on the weekend where you have to stop after each shot and wait and hit. And it, God forbid, the first few groups off the tee in the morning are slow. If they're slow, everything is slow. And it's terrible. It's a terrible experience. And it's just not fun. The playing part isn't fun, at least. So that can reverberate through a course in a professional tournament. So you're ultimately having a bigger impact than just the one or two people in your group. And that has a bigger impact. So you should be impacted by strokes. Not money, strokes. Strokes have a potentially larger impact than money ever could. And when the European Tour... Here's the problem, though, for Keith Pelly. The European Tour is now trying to go out of its way to be a little bit more player-friendly. And you can see it in a number of the initiatives that they've taken. One, shorts. That's player-friendly. Players want to wear shorts. Wear shorts. The other is trying to change the membership requirements. While not really changing them, it makes them a little bit easier to understand and slightly more convenient for players that are on the cusp of the World Top 50. Instead of saying, you have to play in 13 events that include the four major championships and the four World Golf Championships events, which is, you know, eight events, so really you have to find five others. Just find five European Tour events that aren't majors in WGCs somewhere over the course of the year, and you're good. Well, okay, I can do that. That's pretty easy. It seems easy. I mean, you're still playing 13 events, but it seems pretty easy. You're not, especially if you're someone who's on the cusp of maybe not making some of those WGCs or some of those majors, makes it a little bit easier. So that's player-friendly also. And then you come in and say, well, we're going to institute a pace of play penalty that isn't just money, it's strokes. Oh, stop the bus. Wait a second. That's not player-friendly, is it? Well, it's player-friendly to the players who play at a modest pace or a fast pace, not the slow guys. And I think that could kind of halt the brakes on the train of good feelings that everyone's riding with Keith Pelley right now, because he's gone out of his way to do things that make the players happier, and hopefully, he thinks, get them to play his tour more often. More than just the five that's a minimum. And that's what he's hoping for. And so I think that this kind of flies in the face of that. So I don't expect him to suddenly come out a few months later and go, okay, we're going to take the next step with this pace of play policy now. We're going to add strokes. That's not going to happen. I don't see that this year, at least. Maybe after some careful study this year, they decide, okay, we can throw some strokes in there. If you have a third bad time, you get a stroke. Something like that. I don't know what the tiering system of penalties would be for slow play, but I think that would be pretty reasonable. So you got that going on. Meanwhile, we've got one round in the books in Abu Dhabi. We haven't really gotten anywhere in the hope so far, so I can't really speak to that when we're doing this podcast. But you've got Bryson DeChambeau, who carries the lead after day one. He's 864. He had played exactly 18 holes of the course one time before the tournament started. And he said that it's pretty easy to get the feel of the course if you have a topographic map, if you have a contour map, if you know where all the bumps go. I mean, it sounds like a true scientist. And he called himself the golf scientist after he shot 64. He's a physics major at SMU. He's a U.S. amateur and NCAA men's individual champion. He's one of five people to ever pull that task off in a single year. And he's basically, as he calls himself, a professional intern, because he's going to turn pro probably after the Masters, because he gets an invite as an amateur and the U.S. amateur champion to the Masters. So take that and then turn pro. Okay, sounds good. Well, he's ready to go. I mean, he's ready to turn pro. Finished second in the Australian Masters. He's obviously in good position here after, albeit one round, but he's in position to potentially win. And I think this was Ryan Lavner's work over at golfchannel.com, or his Twitter account, I should say. He said if DeChambeau wins, there's an honest opportunity for him to propel into the top 100 in the world as an amateur. Amateur distinction doesn't quite mean so much here because he's playing a little bit of a professional schedule and he's stepped away from his college team in preparation for the Masters and all that other stuff of turning pro. But, I mean, that would be a huge accomplishment. Even if he finished top three and gets himself significantly higher in the world ranking for when he turns pro, he's not in necessarily the worst spot in the world. And if he enjoys this experience and he's been willing to travel to take his game places, he did the Australian Masters, as we mentioned, played in the Argentine Open. So Argentina, Abu Dhabi, the kid's willing to travel. So maybe he's willing to take the Brooks Koepka, Peter Uihlein path of willing to go to Europe, travel the world, enjoy it, not necessarily worry about everything that comes with that yet, and figure out your way to the PGA Tour if you choose, or to the top, however you want to get there. And I think Bryson DeChambeau is going to be a fascinating figure in the sport. Not necessarily going to be revolutionary. I mean, all of a sudden, we're not all going to be swinging 7-iron-length irons with the same swing weight, with the same lie angle, with the same bounce, and the big grip. We're not all going to start doing that. That's not going to change. There are way too many golfers who have done things the way that it's been done as it technologically evolves for all of us to all of a sudden eschew all of that and go, oh, well, you know, maybe we should all swing 7-iron-length 4-iron. I don't know. That's not going to happen. But it works for DeChambeau, and I think that makes him compelling because he knows he's different, and he's happy that he's different. And he's not different because the other way wasn't good. He's different because he thinks this way is better. And I think that flies in the face a lot of the anchoring ban of folks who went to the long putter and the belly putter and anchored it with a stroke, because by and large they did that because they weren't good at the traditional way. It didn't work for them. I don't get the sense that that's the case with DeChambeau with the golfing machine method. The story he tells is he did this in 2011. He got this set and played with it, played a practice round, had an 8-iron into the hole from 160 on the first one, and it went pretty close to the pin. He's like, all right, that's about what you expect. It's not that much of a difference to having swinging a 7-iron length 8-iron to get to a pin. But then He had 210 yards on the next one, his next approach, and hit a 4-iron, again, 7-iron length, and stuck it right next to the pin. He thought this could be a game changer. And I think that's fascinating. I want to see it in action. I want to see it work. I want to know his gaps and his distances. I want to learn more about those things. And I've spent some time working with it. I've used the Jumbo Max grips that he uses. I think they're very interesting, and they have some serious benefits. And I wonder what ultimately this guy's going to look like as a professional, because he's not going to abandon the club setup that works for him. He's done it for too long to try to anything different. And certainly not going to do it at this point, because he's marketable because he's different. So who does he sign with? I mean, he's testing different equipment companies. He's gone to meet with them. And if you're the equipment company, you have to decide if you're willing to play ball by his rules, because he's making the rules here. You're offering the money, but he's making the rules, saying, I'll play your equipment, but you've got to build it to my spec. Do people want to go through that trouble? I don't know. I assume at least one company does. I mean, it's special, but is that crazy? Is it going to take that long to get it dialed in? I mean, guys take time to get dialed in with new equipment that's just made the normal way. How long would it take to get DeChambeau dialed in with a set of whatever irons he signs with? Do we know? And ultimately, are they going to even resemble what you can find on the rack, what you can buy in stores as a player? And if that's not the case, then how marketable is he? He goes, well, I'm playing, say, Cobra clubs, but they're not, you can't get them. You don't want to get them. Or you might, but you're not going to get them. And I'm going to play them just for me. And Cobra goes, well, even if he's a stunning success and wins majors and becomes a very fascinating player, a compelling player, that's not necessarily all that marketable from a sales standpoint, I don't think. So I don't know what the benefit is there to him. So there's just the full package is one of fascination with DeChambeau, and I really cannot wait to see him play more golf. I can't wait to see him how he plays tomorrow. Does he hold up? Does he kind of lose a little something here? I mean, we'll figure out all that out pretty soon. But we've got a very interesting week ahead, and we'll find out more about that. We're going to not take too much time here this week, but be sure to catch out the rest of the Abu Dhabi Championship. I think you're going to find it really interesting. It's a really fun golf course. These guys are going to take it deep this week. You also have in the American desert, in the California desert, you've got a new rotation for the Career Builder, which used to be the Humana, which used to be the Bob Hope Challenge. I think it's going to be a really interesting event too, especially to have the stadium course at PGA West back in the rotation. It was in there once. I think Jeff Shackelford said like 30 years ago. I don't think that was the case, because David Duval shot 59 at PGA West. But that's a difficult golf course. It's a really hard golf course. And if the wind picks up, and it typically doesn't this time of year, but if it does pick up, it's going to be a total outlier in terms of scoring compared to La Quinta, which is fairly benign, and the Nicklaus tournament, which is pretty gettable. Got a pretty decent field there, and I think the guy to keep an eye on naturally is Phil Mickelson. Got a renewed swing with Andrew Jetson. You're going to try and see where he is at almost 46 years of age, and this is kind of the push or go home year for Mickelson, I think, because he's either going to get lapped by the next generation or he's going to hang on for a little while longer. So that's my guy to watch this week, in addition to, like I said, pretty good field for the first mainland PGA Tour event of 2016. That's going to do it for us here this week on the show. Next week, we'll figure out what we figure out from Abu Dhabi. We'll see if Bryson DeChambeau can hang on, and if not, where he winds up in the mix among a great European Tour field, maybe one of the best of the year on the European Tour proper. And then we get ready for the LPGA Tour season with the Coates Championship coming up. Pure Silk's going to kick off the year, and we'll be at the PGA Merchandise Show in Orlando, so we'll have some chatter from there as well, and that's where we'll record this show next week. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. You can follow me on Twitter @RyanBallenge. If you're a big Golf Newsnet fan, we love you just as much as you love us. If you're interested in GNM Plus, check it out on our site. It is for $3 a month or $30 a year, a completely display ad-free experience of our site. You get all of our best news. You get additional content, especially fantasy golf research and data that you won't find elsewhere, at least easily, and equipment research that's forthcoming with all of the 2016 equipment that we're able to test and bring to you, so you know exactly what you're getting right off the club face with all of the TrackMan and launch monitor data that you can stand to have, as well as other exclusive content we're going to put up on the site as well. That's available at golfnewsnet.com. Just check out GNM Plus on the main menu. So until next week, I'm Ryan Ballengee. Thanks so much for listening to our show. We'll catch you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.